Okay, in this week's parsha, we have the death of Sarah. What I want to try to explore a little bit is some of the relationships which exist over here. So the relationships, we have the relationship between Avram and Sarah. We have the relationship, there's a relationship between Sarah and Yitzchak, which we're not going to explore at all. But there are a number of other people who are around the periphery that I think it's also, there's some real interesting things to look at and to try to note and see, you know, how to interpret them.
So let's
Hagar and Ishmael and Nachon, and more. So let's start and let's take a look. Source number one, Vayuchay Sarah, and again I'll say, if anybody needs English, then bring with them. Vayuchay Sarah, Meyashana, Vesimshana, Veshevashanim, Shnechay Sarah. Anybody who looks at that verse, I'll translate it in a second, but anybody who looks at that verse will know that there's too many words. By the way, how do I decide if there are too many words in a verse? So I just decide, how many of you are English majors? None, one. So I just decide if I would edit this. And how do I know if I would edit it? Because I know what my editor does to me. So I've already been trained. So if my editor would edit this and say, no, you can say this more succinctly, so use the same rules by a chumash. If you can say something more succinctly, then say it. Over here, Vayuchay Sarah, Mea Shana, Vesim Shana, Vesheva Shanim. By the way, how could you make that shorter? You can say, she died at 127. That's all you have to say. Vayuchay Sarah, Mea Shana, Vesim Shana, Vesheva Shanim, Shnechay Sarah. And the years of Sarah's life were 100 years and 20 years and 7 years were the years of Sarah's life. Right? Do we all recognize that that really could have been said in a more succinct manner? Yes? So therefore we all agree. Rashi addresses both problems in the text. What's the two problems? One is the Shana, Shana, Shana. And two is the repetition between the beginning and the end of the Pasuk. These are the years of Sarah's life, the years of Sarah's life. 100 years and 20 years and 7 years, those are two separate problems. Rashi writes, "V'yichay Sarah mea shana v'sum shana v'sheva shanim, l'kach nechtav shana b'kol klal v'klal." Why does it say shana each time? Lomer lecha, to tell you, shekol echad nidrash la'atzmo, that each one could be interpreted by itself. Now, by the way, here's something very interesting that I would assume a lot of you have seen this Rashi before, but 9 out of 10 times at least, if I ask somebody to reconstruct the Rashi in their minds, we'll reconstruct it in a way that he didn't say it. Anybody want to try, or should we just read it? Okay, we'll just read it, so I don't get to be amused. Fine. So let's read what Rashi says. He says each one can be interpreted independently. Bat mea shana, bat mea kibat esrim lechet. When she was 100 years old, she was as sinless as a 20-year-old. Ma bat esrim lo chata, just like a 20-year-old doesn't sin. Shere ein bat onshin, because she's not really responsible. Af mea belochet. Uma bat esrim kibat sheva le yofi. And when she was 20, she was as beautiful as a 7-year-old. So now, can you imagine how people in their minds reconstruct this? Of course they do. Why? Because what Rashi says is a little, I won't say disturbing, but it doesn't, I don't know how much it resonates. Because if I were to say 20-year-old, so most of you would say, oh no, 20-year-old is where the beauty should be, and sinless should have been the 7-year-old. So I'm just saying, when people process this, they almost automatically process it wrong, and they reconstruct it in the way that they would like it to say, that she was as sinless as a 7-year-old, and she was as beautiful as a 20-year-old. And maybe it's a little disturbing that Rashi says she's as beautiful as a 7-year-old, and as sinless as a 20-year-old. Right? So which part of Rashi is more disturbing? You're very quiet. You all speak English, right? So which part of Rashi is more disturbing? As beautiful as a 7-year-old. Okay, so the reason that that's disturbing is because in modern times, we interpret beauty and sexuality together. So I say a 7-year-old, wow, she's really beautiful, and you say he's really sick. Because immediately we tend to put together beauty with sexuality. So it's almost saying, oh, as a 7-year-old, she was really hot. And then you say, okay, that person should be locked up. But it's not saying that. It's saying a 7-year-old is beautiful. So now, I'll ask you, are 7-year-old girls beautiful?
Cute.
So okay. No, but they also can have beauty. They have cuteness. They have But I think this goes down to our own definitions and our own societal definitions of beauty and so on. So I'm just saying is that this Rashi, that's why I said people never remember it because what it says disturbs people. Yeah.
Does beauty ever mean youth?
I don't think necessarily.
What does it matter if she's as beautiful as she's
seen? Ah, very good. I'm going to tell you how Rabbi Soloveitchik explained this Rashi. I have to first explain in terms of the 20-year-old also. The 20-year-old who's little. Any of you under 20 still? Okay, good. Else I can't explain this. What is Rashi saying? That we have a tradition that there's such a thing which is called Chiyuv Karet. Chiyuv Karet means your soul gets wiped out. According to what Rashi's telling us, he's repeating tradition, that anybody who's under 20 cannot be guilty of karet. Which means even though that when all of you were bat mitzvah, they told you, okay, now you're an adult, now you've grown up, now you're responsible, very nice, but it's just not true. Which means that now you start getting reward for all the good things that you do, which bar mitzvah or bat mitzvah, but still, till the age of 20, a person, what does the halacha really assume? It assumes that people, when they're young, are going to do stupid things, and they're not responsible for it. I don't know if that is absolutely shocking to you, but that's what halacha, Jewish law, that's what halacha absolutely assumes, is that teenagers do stupid things, and that's true across societies. Teenagers do stupid things, and therefore they're not held responsible for it, and anything, again, you all appreciate why they never told you this in high school, right? This would open the door for a lot of partying. So it says that till the age of 20, the person's not responsible. And that's exactly what this Rashi's saying. Again, if you didn't see the words, when she was as 100, she was as sinless as a 20-year-old. Ma bat esrim lo chata, she didn't sin. Why? Shuri enu bat onchin. She's not old enough that she's considered to be somebody who could be punished. Lo bat onchin. They get a free pass, which means just like, you know, today in terms of the legal system. Anybody studying law? What are you studying? Okay. That in the legal system, that if somebody is underage and does a certain crime, so what is the legal system going to do? Okay, we can't do anything with you because you're underage. So in halacha, what's considered the underage in terms of both bat to be a ben or bat onchin, in terms of things l'shamayim, in terms of, again, not just legal system, in terms of God, this is not just talking about our ability to punish, it's talking about God's willingness to punish, that it says that somebody who's under the age of 20, God says that person is considered to be innocent because they're still not mature. The frontal brain lobe or whatever is not well enough developed that this person should be held responsible for what they've done. Does that make any sense?
So what do the bar mitzvahs?
Get presents. It's till the age of bar or bat mitzvah the parents get punished for the sins of the kid. Because they should be raising them. But from 13 to or 12 to 20, then nobody's getting the punishments for that. That's why they say Baruch Shepatrani. Big question is why we don't say it by girls. Nobody has a good answer for that. And so, yeah, she said it. Baruch Shepatrani. What does that mean? That I'm no longer going to be held responsible for them. Anyway, so here's what Rabbi Soloveitchik did with this Rashi. And the first thing I will tell you is that he did what he always does, and that is that he took liberties. He tended often, especially when he taught Parsha. Okay, I'll tell you a couple of things about him teaching Parsha, because I know that at the end of the day, you're going to remember the stories more than you remember anything else that I say. He gave two major Parsha classes, and there was a third. But generally, he taught Gemara. In Boston, which is where he lived, he gave a Saturday night shiur. And that Saturday night shiur was essentially designed to bring people in. And you got a lot of university professors and students, and it was basically, he knew his competition was the movies. Either people were going out to the movies, going out to dinner, or come. So he made it as theatrical and exciting and interesting as he possibly could. That was his agenda for the Saturday night class. But he also used to give one on Wednesday nights. He would give a parsha share on Wednesday nights. So here's the unwritten story behind this. And this is, I think, very interesting. There were, after his wife died, which was 1967, he had yeshiva guys would come and take care of him. They'd shop for him, take care of his things, and like they were there on call to help him. But as you can imagine, a number of yeshiva guys like to hang out with him because, you know, it's pretty cool to hang out with Rabbi Soloveitchik. So they would hang out in his apartment. And one night, this is late 70s, he looks in the room and he goes, "What are you people doing here?" Like just suddenly, they said, "Why are you here?" So they said, "Rebbe, we're here to help you." So he says, "Well, why aren't you married or like with your wife and kids? Or why are you here?" So then one of them says, "You know, it's not so easy to meet girls. You know, we're not going to go, you know, on the one hand, we're not the type to go on shiduchim," which was certainly with modern Orthodox American Jews in the late 70s, that was absolutely the case. On the other hand, we're not going to hang out in front of Stern College and just try to pick up anybody walking by, because that's not terribly dignified either. So he listens, and they say, "We have a hard time getting girls." So he says, "Okay, I have an idea. I'll give a parsha shir, open it up to everybody. I'll get the girls in the room, but you got to walk over and talk to them afterwards." And that's why he gave the parsha shir for the next, whatever, how many years it was, close to 10 years, he gave the parsha shir, simply as a way that a young man and young woman could meet. So that year also, it wasn't as dramatic, but as I said, he certainly, when he was teaching these things, he would take liberties with the text. And here's what he said in terms of Sarah's life. He said that most people in life go through stages, right? We're children, we're teenagers, we're adults, and we can keep on going from there. Most people, when they go from one stage to the other, lose the old stage, and then they get this new stage. If you look at the last couple of words in this Rashi, Rashi writes, Shnei Chayei Sarah. Here he's addressing why that is repeated as well, because it's in the beginning of the verse and the end of the verse. Rashi writes, Kulon Shavin L'Tova. They were all equal in a positive sense. So he says, what does that mean? They're all equal in a positive sense. So that's exactly the point. Most people in life go from one stage to the other and lose the next. So he goes, okay, what is the beauty of a seven-year-old? So he didn't try to change the Rashi and all. Rav Hirsch, if I'm not mistaken, tries to change it to make it more politically correct. He says, what's the beauty of a seven-year-old? So he said, the beauty of a seven-year-old, maybe this is close to what one of you wanted to say, he said, is innocence. He goes, what is a seven-year-old is innocence. By the way, does make a difference, seven-year-old girls, even seven-year-old boys have innocence. Seven-year-olds, there's something very touching. You know, with all the, you know, the bad things going on right now, and you know, we're living right now at a time of some tension. So the only solace I can offer you is that I remember when times are much worse. And right, going back some 20 years or so, when they had the bus bombings and so on, and you know, it was terrible. And I remember my kids, you know, very little at the time, 4 or 5 years old, who before they went to sleep would ask, you know, can we say Tehillim now? Can we say Tehillim for the people that are wounded and so on? And there was just something very, very innocent about a child's prayer. And because a child can pray not the way that we pray. How do we pray when we pray? We say, God, if you exist and if you're listening and if you care and if you're going to do anything about this and you don't want to torture me, then so on. Which is, we just have all of this stuff in our heads before we can actually say what we want to say. A child doesn't pray like that. A child says, God, please help. And by the way, with full belief that God exists and full belief that God exists, with listening and full belief that God cares and full belief that God is going to do something about it, which means the child's prayer is completely different. And Rabbi Soloveitchik said, the beauty of Sarah was that when she was 20 years old, she was as beautiful as a seven-year-old. But in terms of what? In terms of what is the beauty of a seven-year-old? The beauty of a seven-year-old is innocence. So therefore, when she was 20 years old, now what happens to a lot of us when we become 20? Our innocence gets replaced with cynicism. Yes or no? Our innocence gets replaced with cynicism, and we're questioning, and we're not so sure, and the world looks a little different. And he says, no, Sarah, her whole life was as innocent as a seven-year-old. Now what is the greatness of a 20-year-old? What does a 20-year-old have? So again, he here ignored the text completely. What does a 20-year-old have? A 20-year-old has strength. A 20-year-old has ideology. A 20-year-old believes that they can change the world. A 20-year-old believes, you know, we're going to be different. Our generation is going to be different. We're going to do it differently. We're not going to fall into the same mistakes and patterns that previous generations. The 20-year-old has strength and ideology. What does the 100-year-old, the elderly person have? The elderly person has wisdom. And by the way, that is also one of the sins of our generation, is that we sometimes fail to note the wisdom of elderly people. that we replace wisdom with technology. So therefore, if somebody doesn't know how to use technology, how smart could they possibly be? And but people that are people who have lived through life, have gone through experiences, they have wisdom. They have great wisdom. And he said that the greatness of Sarah, why does it say she was 100 years old and she was 20 years old and she was 7 years old? He said because Kulam Shavim L'Tova, again, the last comment of Rashi, she did not experience what most people experienced. Most people move from the innocence of a child to the ideology of the teenager and go from the ideology of the teenager to the wisdom of the old person. He said the greatness of Sarah is that she always, her whole life, she had all three elements. She was always wise, she always had idealism, and she was always innocent, in a positive way. Innocent, by the way, has become such a bad word that it's pejorative today. You say, oh, she's very innocent. It's almost as you said something very bad about them. He says, no, Sarah's innocence was the most beautiful innocence, trust in God type of innocence. So he says, that's really that in a sense really is a eulogy. That's the eulogy for Sarah. That's the Torah's eulogy for Sarah. She was 100 years old and 20 years old and 70 years old, and she, Shnei Chaye Sarah. She always, those are the years of her life. She was always 100, always 20, and always 7, and unlike most people who go from one stage to the other. Okay, so that's the first statement in terms of Sarah's life. Now, in many ways, Sarah and Avraham endured great difficulties in their lives. Again, if you want to start with the long years of infertility, the various moving that takes place, going from one country to another, I mean, maybe it's one of the things that you that also we don't think about enough. You know, to be a new person in a country is not a very easy experience. Maybe a lot of you are olim chadashim, or you've experienced that yourself. It's not a very easy move to make, but they moved around a bit. They did move around from place to place. And it wasn't always simple. When Sarah suffers from her infertility, she says something that to modern people I think is a little bit strange. And that is, you know, take Hagar. Although in today's world maybe we can couch it in terms of surrogate motherhood and so on. The thing that I want you to note in terms of this relationship is that there's a lot of, again, at first glance, contradictory information. I think we can resolve it all. But what was the relationship of Hagar to Sarah, and what was the relationship of Hagar to Avraham? And was it the same relationship? I guess I should keep on talking. You're not answering, right? Right. So I will have a monologue. I'm in Perek Tet Zayin right now. I did not produce this for you. The Sarai Eshet Avraham Lo Yoldalo Vila Shifat Mitzrit Mishma Hagar. Anything jump out at you when I read that text? V'sarai eshet Avram lo yadalo v'la shivcha mitzrit u'shma Hagar. What did it say about Sarai or Sarai in this context? It doesn't say every other time she's mentioned. It called her eshet Avram. It could have just said it was Sarai, but it stresses the relationship. And today's going to be our relationship. It stresses the relationship. What's the relationship? Sarai is eshet Avram. And what does she have? V'la shivcha mitzrit. Mishma Hagar. So what's the relationship between her and Hagar? Hagar is a shivcha, a servant. But Tomer Sarai El Avram, Hinena Atzarani Hashem Yiledet, Bana Et El Shivchati. Have relations with my shivcha. So one second. Again, is that relationship very, very clear? Who is Hagar? She's a shivcha. Ulai Ibanem Imenav Yishma Avram L'Kol Sarai. And Avram, once again, listens to what Sarah tells him. V'tikach Sarai Eshet Avram. Again, you notice what word I'm going to emphasize? Eshet. Et Hagar HaMitzrit Shivchata. Again, by the way, you realize now this is completely redundant, but I think that there's emphasis here. Miketz Eser Shanim L'Shevet Avram Be'eretz Kanan. V'titein Ota LaAvraham Isha Lo LeIsha. Should I translate? And she gives him over, she gives her over to Avram, her husband, Isha. She gives to Avram her husband, Lo Le'isha, as a wife. Now that's very interesting. Because what could have it said? As a Shifcha, which means it could have just extended this relationship. So now, talk about complexity. What is the relationship? And by the way, this is going to carry all the way through. What is the relationship between Avram and Hagar? Hagar is his wife. What's the relationship between Hagar and Sarah? It's her servant. So it could have been, it would have been very easy to say his servant or his wife's servant, but it doesn't say that. It actually says he gives her over as a wife. So as I said, that is something which is very interesting. And the whole dynamics now, you can understand how everything can get completely confused. You're thinking something, right? What do you, I saw you thinking. Pasuk Dalet. Do we have this? Here where you begin to have the Midrash on this. In Source 3, you have the Midrash quoted. Right? Oh, sorry. First, you have the Pasuk. So let me read now the next Pasuk. Vayavo el Hagar. Avram has relations with Hagar. Vatahar. And she becomes pregnant. Vatera ki harata. And when she sees that she became pregnant, Vatekal gvirta be'ineha. Vatekal comes from the word kal. Lightened, diminished. But tekel gvirta beinah, and her mistress, or how do you say, the feminine of master, her right, her gvirta, her mistress became diminished in her eyes, and then Sarah seems completely flippant, and she says, "Vatoma Sarai Avram, chamasi alecha, anochi netati shivchati bechekecha." I gave you my servant. He goes, I'm mad at you. I gave you my servant, and now she became pregnant. And I become light. Like God judged. Why is she all upset now? What's happened? So this leads me to a larger issue. The larger issue is, who was Sarah? Which means, we have this really fascinating couple, Avraham and Sarah. And maybe we can use this as some kind of metaphor for all, you know, Jewish leadership throughout the ages. I'm going to give you two possibilities. If you want, I'll give you three possibilities. First possibility is Sarah really the brains behind the operation and Avram just the front man? Two, is Avraham really the leading person, the main person, and Sarah is just the one who makes cookies for the guests? Or is there some kind of equal stature between the two of them? And by the way, it's very easy right now to get involved in through our own perception in terms of our sensibilities and read our sensibilities into the text. It's always easy to do that. But what I'd prefer to do is try to understand the sensibilities of the text instead of, you know, reading our own sensibilities. So, by the way, which one do you prefer? You prefer Sarah in charge? You prefer equality? Or Avram in charge? Let Avram make it. Right, I'm just a woman. Let my husband make all the decisions. Which one do you prefer? Will you give up already? Equality. We like equality. So in terms of equality, I think that's the secret of understanding everything which is going on over here. Note that after Sarah dies, Avram lives a long time. Again, there's a 10-year age gap between the two of them. Right? She's 90, he's 100 when she gives birth. She's 127 when she dies. Which means he's 137. He lives all the way into his 180s. Because Avram, that's a long time. But we don't hear anything about Avraham. What do we hear? We hear that he buries her, and then he tries to find a wife for Yitzchak, which, by the way, are the first two chapters of this week's parsha. And I think that those chapters are absolutely connected to one another. And then he passes away. Now, it happens to be that if you do the math, you come to the realization that Avram is still alive when Yitzchak is married. Avram is still alive when the boys are born, and they're born after 20 years of Yitzchak's and Rivka's infertility. Then they're born, and Avram doesn't die, I believe, until the boys are 15 years old. By the way, if we were writing this, there would be one at least very nice scene of, you know, little Yaakov sitting on Avram's knee, and talking to him, and you know, what was it like, and the old days, the old country. Right? That has a real nice touch to it. But Avram's still alive, but we don't hear anything about Avram. That's interesting. Again, sometimes what the text doesn't say is interesting. So the silence over here is presumably, unless you want to say that Yitzhak is real mad at his father for pulling a knife on him, and has a hard time with him afterwards. One of the beautiful things that comes out from Rashi is that Abraham sends out his servant to go and find a wife for Yitzhak. At the same time, it says Yitzhak goes. Where's the next time we see Yitzhak? By the way, we don't see Yitzhak for a very long time. And this is another piece of information which can take in all kinds of ways. From the time that Yitzhak was laying on the Akedah until we find him in the field at the end of the second parak in this week's Parsha, right after the servant comes home, it says that he was coming from the field. We don't see Yitzhak at all. Where was Yitzhak? Where was he afterwards? So you can say all kinds of things. Of course, what's going to be the normative rabbinic response? He must be in yeshiva. That's whenever you don't know where somebody is. Okay, he's in yeshiva now. It's the best alibi that people ever have. He's in yeshiva. He's learning. But Yitzhak disappears. And the army direction say he went to Gan Eden. Also, the direction said Avram killed him and he died, and that's why he went to Gan Eden. But where is he? Anybody know? Where is Yitzhak when we find him all those years later? It says that he's coming from a place which is called Be'er. Yeah, look at source number 9. No, it's not. Not source 9. Sorry, it's not there. What? He goes to Be'er Lahai-Ro'i. He goes to the same Be'er that God revealed himself to Yishmael. So Rashi there says, why is he going there? He's going to bring Hagar back to his father. So one second, do you realize the beauty of that? That Avram is busy looking to find a wife for his son, and because it's time for him to get married, and Yitzhak is busy looking for somebody for his father, because his father needs companionship also. So again, so there's just something very nice about that relationship here, that each one really cares about the other one. So let us get back to our question in terms of equality. Again, I'm telling you a point that Rabbi Soloveitchik made. I'll use his words. He said that when Sarah dies, Avram steps off the stage as well. He says you cannot have an Avram without a Sarah. He's no longer Avram. And if later on he reunites with Hagar, very good. It's Avram and Hagar, if in fact the Torah is the same. But that's it. Because the leadership over here, right, is Avram and Sarah. It's not just that Sarah baked the cookies and Avraham was the one who did all the spiritual stuff. Matter of fact, there was a very early verse when we first met them. What did it say? When they came to Eretz Canaan, V'hanefesh esher asu b'charan. It doesn't say nefesh esher asa. Nefesh esher asu b'charan. What's asu? It's plural, both of them. What does Rashi say on that verse? Avraham gierta anashin v'sarat gira eta nashin. That Avraham dealt with the men and women. So here we have a very good sniyut. Maybe mentioned not be teaching in midrashot at all. But that seems to be, again, right there from Rashi, you see that the men were teaching the men and the women were teaching the women. Avram and Sarah, partners, equals, both of them accomplishing things which are spiritual. And I'll say it again, Rabbi Soloveitchik's point is once Sarah dies, then Avram's no longer Avram. Avram can only be Avram when he has Sarah with him. Now, keeping this in mind, I want to go back to the dual relationship that takes place with Hagar. Now, do we all now sense that there is, in fact, a dual relationship? The dual relationship is such that her relationship with Sarah is that Sarah is the master and she's the slave. And that's very clear. Keep saying, shikra, shikra, shikra. But when it comes to Avram, then she gives her servant to Avram, Isha, le'isha. Her husband, Isha, is her husband, as a wife. Which seems to be that Sarah is saying, it seems to be, again, if you people actually spoke, then maybe somebody would say this or something else. It seems to be that Avraham, that it's, perhaps it's unseemly for Avram to be intimate with somebody that he's not married with. Right? Again, you're dealing with the olden days, if you married more, maybe it's unseemly to be married more than one person also, and you can decide what's better. I mean, it's better to be married to somebody else, or is it better to... Is it better to be married to somebody else, or better just have a child with somebody else? I don't know how to answer that, but it sounds to me that Sarah, again, this is Sarah's call.
But he didn't marry Hagar?
I think that's the question. Forget about real marriage. Forget if they had a chuppah on that, right? Or if they had to go through the rabbanut, right? All that's not important. The question is the relationship. Does Hagar have a relationship as a servant, or does he have a relationship as a wife? That's really the question over here. And what's the answer? The answer is we have conflicting information. What's the conflicting information? That Sarah sees her as her servant, and she is, but she gives her to Abraham as a wife. And see, that's right there is where it got interesting. So if she's the wife, so she's still her servant, or she's a further servant. Why does Sarah get upset? And again, my moral of the story would be that if your wife says to sleep with this cleaning lady, don't do it, right? That's, you don't agree with such a thing, right? Everything that Sarah says is good, but not that. But over here, doesn't Sarah look fickle, right? She looks completely fickle. She says, marry her, and then he's with her, and then he goes, well, you know, God's going to judge between the two of you. What in the world did you do? So Sarah seems unstable. Sarah's very stable. There was a shift. So what was the shift? I mean, you all should, the answer should be obvious now. What the shift was? The shift, what?
Hagar changed her perception.
That Hagar diminished her perception of Sarah. Which means, I don't know what the economic relationship is, but she's not looking at her the same way. Again, the words aren't. Avram had relations with Hagar, and she became pregnant. Batera ki harata, and when she saw that she was pregnant, but take a look at Virta Beinah. Then Sarah became diminished in her eyes. But Thomas Sarai Avram chamasielach anochi natati shivchati bechagecha. I gave my servant in your arms. Batera ki harata, and she saw that she got pregnant. But ikal beinah, and I become diminished. Yishpot Hashem din yivenecha. God's going to judge between us. So again, why is she so upset? She's so upset she's so upset because something has happened over here. And Hagar has made a mistake, and Hagar, for that matter, is staking a claim.
But isn't that Hagar's fault, not Abraham's fault?
Correct. What then does Abraham say again? Listen carefully to Abraham's response. V'yomar Avram el Sarai, hinei shivchatech biyadech. What does he call her? A shivchat. A selah hatov beinayich. Which, by the way, is very obvious. She is your servant. V'ta'anah Sarai abused her. By the way, why did she abuse her? Because Sarai is mean, and because she should be punished for this, there are Rishonim who don't like what she did. Why does she do this? To prove the relationship again. Wash the floors, wash them again. No, they're not clean enough, do it again. So why is Sarah acting like this? Well, she's acting like this, again, I don't know the exact example, but she's acting like this, why? Because something has happened over here, and Hagar is taking a claim. Now, there's something which is real interesting about Hagar, but, okay, just continue.
She was still Sarah's servant.
Right. So, as I said, we have contradictory information. Malach, she runs away. Hashem el in hamayim b'midbar. A malach finds her, right? Vayomer Hagar, and what does the malach say? This is great. This is Perek Zayin Pasuk Bet. Vayomer Hagar shifchat Sarai. What does the malach say? Just as he introduced, he puts her in her place right away. Amy Zabata, Va'ana Telchi, where are you coming? Where are you going to? Vadomine Sarai Givirti Anochi Barachat. I'm running away from Sarah, my, again, the master. Vayoma Malach Hashem, Shubi El Gvirtech, Vehitanita Chat Yadeh. Go back and continue the relationship. You are the Shivcha. By the way, when Yishmael is born, but Taylor Hagar la Avram ben, it doesn't say the relationship. So again, this point of this relationship needs to be explored. Every single time Hagar's name is mentioned, you need to take a look and see who is talking to her and what is the relationship, what is she being described as now. There's something which is very interesting about Hagar, which is claimed by the Midrash. Let's take a look. Source number 3. Vatikach Sarai Eshet Avram et Hagar haMitzrit Shivchata. Lecha b'dvarim. She, what do you mean? She took her. She took her by words. By the way, the word tikach sometimes is related to marriage. Vayikach ish isha. So sometimes the word can imply some kind of a formal relationship. You're very fortunate that you're now going to be united spiritually, physically with Avram. Amar Rav Shimon Yochai. Rav Shimon Yochai said, Hagar, who is Hagar? Bito Shoparo Haitan. That she was the daughter of Paro. Now this is very important. And I suspect that you've heard this before, yes? Okay, so that's important. Okay. That the Midrash is telling us that Hagar is in reality the daughter of Paro. Now, hold on. Where is the Midrash getting it from? So there is the simple reading, and then what I think is a much deeper reading. So let's start with the simple. The simple thing is what it sounds like what the Midrash is doing. It's something, again, very straightforward. Avram and Sarai go down to Egypt. They come out of Egypt with all kinds of things. So one of the things they came out of was Hagar. Again, it's simple as that. She was taken and abused by Paro, so therefore she leaves with Paro, gives her various things. And that's a little surprising that one of the things that Paro gives is his daughter, but let's read the way the Midrash puts it. What did Paro see just now? What did he see? He sees that his whole house is struck with plagues, right? Well, again, if it's not clear, the Ramban quotes the Midrash Tanchuma, and it gives us a principle which is one of the great principles of the Torah. It's Maaseh Avot Siman Labanim. The things that happened in the past are going to reverberate and happen again in the future. Maaseh Avot Siman Labanim. So therefore, there's a famine, and Avram and Sarah go down to Egypt. Many years later, there's going to be a famine, and the Jewish people go down to Egypt. When the Jewish people go down to Egypt, what's going to happen? There's going to be, power is going to come out and say, kill the men, and let's keep the women over here. Avram, who's the male, feels threatened, and Sarah is taken. What happens next? Power gets stuck with plagues, and the Jews, right, and both cases, power gets stuck with plagues, and the Jews leave, bless you, b'rechush gadol, they leave with great wealth. What happens when Avram leaves? He leaves with b'rechush gadol. So therefore, the Ramban, again, quoting the Tanchuma, says, oh look, here's Maaseh Avot Siman Labanim. It's just, But what does that mean? It means that, on one level, that the experiences of Avraham, this is what the Rabban says, the experiences of Avraham creates the reality that's going to happen afterwards. Which means it almost seems to say that if Avraham didn't go in to Egypt, the Jews never would have, and the plagues didn't happen then, the plagues couldn't happen in the future. I'm not saying the Rabban goes so far, but that's the way it sounds. There are others who say it differently. Maybe, perhaps we'll get another chance of looking at this in some other places where it's used. But in the meantime, it sounds like this is what creates the reality. The later reality is created by the earlier behavior. So Avram is a spiritual giant. And by the way, the Ramban reads all of Avram's behaviors this way. Where's the first place he goes to when he gets to Eretz Yisrael? He goes to Shechem. Where's the first place that Yaakov comes back to? He also comes back to Shechem. Where's the first place that the Jews come to when they cross over? Where they how Grizam Harival or right by Shem, which means the Ramban is going to see this as that the later reality is created by the earlier behavior. Okay, so as I said, that's one way of understanding this. So what do we now know? What does Paro see? Paro sees plagues, Paro sees divine intervention, Paro sees this power of God. So what does Paro then say? Continue in source number 3. But Tikach Sarai Yishat Avram Etek, sorry, next line. Amar Shem Yochai, Hagar, Bito Shaparo Haita, V'Kevan Shara Paro Ma'asim Shanasu L'Sarah B'Veito, Natal Bito V'Natnalo. When Paro saw all the miracles, he took his daughter and gave her to Sarah and said, Mutav Shetehe Biti Shivcha B'Bayit Zeh, it's better for my daughter to be a servant in this house, V'Lug V'Ra B'Bayit Acher, and not to be the head, the mistress, the head of the house, in a different house. Let's pause there. Can we get into Hagar's mindset now? According to this Midrash, Hagar was born as a princess. What else does this tell us? By the way, one in terms of Hagar's mindset, and two in terms of Sarai's choice. Okay, I'll ask you an impossible question. If you were going to have your husband sleep with somebody, what kind of person would you have him sleep with? Or is that a really bad question to ask? But you realize, no, I'm saying you'll realize how ridiculous that is. But I'm asking it anyway.
No, but it makes sense that she's a princess. She doesn't want like some.
Yeah, so you start to think about it. You can go one of two directions. One is you can get the person, the woman who is ugliest, dumbest,
gross.
And what?
Said gross.
Which means the least challenge possible. Or you can try to find somebody with the greatest makeup, as it were, because ultimately, why do we want there to be a child? Okay, A, you can say just so that Avram gets to fulfill the male ego, let me have a child thing. Or more realistically here, there's a problem. What's the problem? Who takes over afterwards for Avram and Sarah? And it's not just a family business. Who takes over now in terms of the covenant with God? So therefore, Sarah, when she looks at it, does something which, I want you to appreciate this choice. The choice that she makes by choosing Hagar is a very elevated choice. She goes, again, according to this midrash, that she's a princess. So Sarah's looking around and saying, who is the most eligible person here? Basically, Avram is also royalty. Who is an appropriate spouse for Avram, or mate for Avram, or someone to bring a child in the world of Avram? So she looks around and says, Hagar, the Egyptian princess, is the best person. So one second. So this midrash, I think, now fills in a little bit of information in terms of how we're looking at Sarah, right? Because in terms of this choice. Now, how do we look at Hagar? What's going on in Hagar's mind? Hagar...
She's getting her position again.
Right. She was born...
Not that she was born, as a shikha. She was born as a princess. Now she's going back to...
Right. So Hagar was born to be queen. She was born to be queen. And, you know, she was supposed to be the queen of Egypt, but as, you know, as fate had it, she ends up coming to Avram's house. But now she's going to be the queen of the Avram household. So therefore, and what proves this point for her?
Where she looks at Sarah, looks down.
Correct. That's correct what I'm saying. But what solidifies this point in her mind? That she got pregnant. So therefore, this is divine already. This is God saying, Sarah is an imposter, but Hagar... is the real one. Well, by the way, do you all think now I'm reading too much into this? Or do you understand now how the dynamic perhaps has changed over here? Which means, normally, the ability to get pregnant is not exactly a proof of anything other than... Okay, I'm not going to finish that sentence. I mean, it doesn't prove anything. Right? All kinds of people can get pregnant. But she's reading this in a completely different way. And that's why immediately what happens over here is this response. She has this very interesting relationship. What is it? She's clearly Sarah's servant. But she may see herself as Avraham's wife. Why does she see it that way? Because that's what Sarah said. Take her as a wife. She gets pregnant immediately. So what does she then do? She starts to look down on Sarah. Now, by the way, all this, just in case you think I'm making this all up, the Midrash says this black and white. Look at source 4, Vayavo el Hagar v'tar v'tere ki harata v'te kal gvirata be'ina. That's the verse I read before. Source number 5. Vayu matroniot ba'ot l'shol b'shloma shel Sarah. And people, women, would come and ask Sarah, how are you doing? V'ta Sarah omeret lehem tzu u'shalu Bishlomo shel aluva, go and ask this miserable woman how she's doing. Vayta Hagar omeret lehem, and this is what Hagar would say. Sarai gvirti, my mistress, Sarai, ein sitra kigluya. What does that mean? Ein sitra kigluya. She's not the same on the inside like she is on the outside. Near eight, Tzadeket, she looks like she's a righteous woman, right? I mean, she covered her hair, and she only wears skirts, and on and on and on. Yes, she looks like she's a tzadeket. Ve'ena tzadeket, but she's not a tzadeket. Ilu haita tzadeket, had she really been a tzadeket, re'u kama shanim shelo nit'abra. Look for how long they remained together, and she did not get pregnant. Va'ani, Belaila echad, in one night, nitabarti, I became pregnant. Which means, again, this is straight off what the Midrash is saying. She got pregnant, she looks down at her. How does she look down at her? She says she's not what she thinks. She's not what she makes believe she is. She makes believe. Sarah Emanu was the first one who made believe that she's some famous Rebbetzin, a big tzaddikid, and what is she? She's a fraud. At least in the words of?
But it's not that she sees her do something wrong, or...
Why not? She suffered under her, though. Like, she... To her, Sarai really did hurt her.
Yeah, but that makes sense.
That's afterwards. That's only afterwards. That's after she the relationship...
She's not mentioning it.
Well, we don't know what happened.
No, but I'm saying that that's the only time that we see it. We see, again, please take her. She gets pregnant. She looks down on Sarah. And then Sarah starts to abuse her at that point to establish the relationship. Which is, that's Sarah's response, but it's not the first stage. So I'm just pointing out that, again, this whole relationship just now became that much more interesting because Hagar seems to be making a claim. Her claim is that Sarah is a fraud. But by the way, again, why is she claiming that Sarah is a fraud? It's not because Sarah is not the issue. What's the real issue? That she wants to claim that she's the one who really should be the one who's. Which means, let's put it this way. You know, as I pointed out before, that as soon as Sarah dies, Avraham disappears as well. Especially according to the Midrash, and we all know, at least maybe we should know, or we will know now, that the Midrash works with something that we can call the theory of conservation of characters. If Avraham married one person, it becomes the same person later. Torah and Hagar is the same person, at least according to the Midrash. So, Avraham could be married to, he can have Pelegish this, or married to this, or with this, or this. He only has one wife. His only wife, which means, who's he buried with? The Marat Machpelah? He's buried next to Sarah. Everything else, I don't want to say it like this, because it's going to sound wrong. Everything else is just a fling. Does that sound wrong? That Avraham had a fling? It was really bad that I said it like that? So I apologize. But that's exactly what it's trying to say. That this partnership is Avram and Sarah. And that's why God comes and says, whatever Sarah says, you should listen to. Why? Again, and now you know what Chazal says. Now Chazal makes so much more sense. Because Sarah is she's a prophet. She knows what's going on. She's spiritually attuned. If she's doing this for the right reason. Listen to what Sarah says over here. But and for Avram it's very difficult. You know, how can I do this? How can I send Ishmael away? Don't listen to him. Because, again, it is. God knows, and Sarah knows, that it's Avraham and Sarah together, not Avraham and Hagar. Meaning that's not a negotiable point. By the way, you could not go back and ask. So if that's the case, then why did Sarah do this at all? Unless she envisioned that Hagar would know her place. That Hagar would have a son with Avraham. But this, so the language is a little different. If you compare this language with by Bilhah later on, by Rachel and Bilhah, there Rachel says black and white, with maybe what Sarah was thinking, maybe not. You can debate that. There Rachel says, take Bilhah and have a child, and I will raise that child on my knee. Which means Rachel says, that will be my child. Which means there we really see much more of a surrogate mother relationship. That Bilhah will give birth to my child. That's really what Rachel says. Whether Sarah said this or not, I don't know. As I said, you can start reading the verses, with more sensitivity and check what it says and what it doesn't say. But whether she had that in mind or not, it's not what happened. Right away, before there is a child, Hagar already starts her PR campaign, and she starts to say, "Listen, Sarah is not who you thought she was. Sarah is not." Which, and again, I want to go back to her identity as far as the Midrash is concerned. What's this identity? The woman who would be, the woman who would be queen. Hagar is the woman who would be queen, and now she finally has her kingdom. She will be the queen. She thought she was going to be the queen in Egypt. By the way, I don't know if you know this, but I also don't know what to do with this. But in ancient Egypt, you know that all the pharaohs married their sisters. Yes, pharaohs married their sisters in ancient. So she was born in Egypt. She was destined to marry one of her brothers and become the queen of Egypt. By the way, I always wondered, keeping that in mind, what Avraham is saying when he says, "Oh, that's my sister." Which means saying that you're your sister to Paro is saying that she's my wife. Okay, it's just a very, very sharp comment. But by the way, if I'm right, then Avraham is saying, "Yeah, you're a king and I'm a king. Yeah, it's my sister." So, but still, It's just an interesting piece of information, as I said, just to process the entire thing, especially the relationships. But no, but that part, as I said, that's historically true in terms of the pharaohs marrying their sisters. So over here, you have Agar who thinks that I'm the one who's supposed to be queen. So now she's going to become the queen of the house of Sarah. So all that now, I hope, makes a little bit more sense. But I think there's a deeper message to this whole midrash. By the way, to make it even better, just to make the story even better, those of you who didn't know that she's the daughter of Paro, to make it even better, right? How do you make that better? If you look at the Targum Yonatan. Now, those of you who don't know, there is a Targum Yonatan ben Uziel on Navi. There is not a Targum Yonatan ben Uziel on Chumash. If you open up your Chumash like I do right over here, it indeed says Yonatan ben Uziel. It's not. This is actually what in scholarly places will always refer to as pseudo Yonatan. It's not Yonatan. What happened is they just messed up in terms of the Rosh Hashanah book. It said Targum, like probably Yisrael or Yerushalayim, and somebody just decided must be Targum Yonatan. It's not. But in the Targum Yonatan, or the fake Targum Yonatan, which is an Aramaic, so today there's a book you can get, which is called the Keter Yonatan, which translates the Targum back into Hebrew. Right? So it goes from Hebrew to Aramaic back into Hebrew, but the Targum Yonatan is very different than the Targum Onkelos. Onkelos is almost exclusively word for word, I would say, except for some notable and most prominently would be wherever things are poetic, then it starts giving you the figurative meaning instead of the literal meaning. The Targum Yonatan weaves Midrashim into the text. So if you look at source number 6, at the end of the fourth line, it says, Hagar bat Paro ben Nimrod, shehitilcha l'kibshon ha'esh. So it just goes with the relationship one step further, and it tells us that who was this Hagar? She's the daughter of Paro, but who's Paro? Paro's the son of Nimrod. So here you have, by the way, this is very interesting, because you have Avram's nemesis, Nimrod, and now the Nimrod's nemesis actually coming into Avram's house. But the Targum doesn't stop there. When Avram goes to war in the four kings against the five kings, that's the Targum in source number 7. V'kasher shama Avram ki nishva achiv chimeshet bachurav shechinech v'milchama migdulei beito v'lo ratzu lechet sham imo v'yevchor mehem et Eliezer ben Nimrod. He takes his servant, Eliezer. Who does it say Eliezer's father is? Nimrod. By the way, that's all you've heard the Midrash. He takes 318 men with him. So there's a Midrash that says Eliezer, because Eliezer equals 318. He only took one person. How can you have one person such a fierce warrior? So it says Eliezer is the son of Nimrod. So therefore, Nimrod tries to kill Avraham, and in the end, his son and his granddaughter end up joining Avraham's family. So you just have to appreciate the poetic justice in all this. But, as I said, that just as a side point. Remember we talked a couple of minutes ago about the Maaseh Avot Siman Labanim? Yes? When the Jews leave Egypt, doesn't the daughter of Paro have a role in that whole story? This is a rhetorical question. What's the answer? Yes. She has a very prominent role in that whole story. So I think that that's the deeper message over here of trying to say that Hagar is the daughter of Paro, because that, again, when I say Maaseh Avot Siman Labanim, that is going to be, you're going to have the Siman Labanim later, so where's the Maaseh Avot? Which means, right? Now, this daughter of Paro, what was her name? What was her name? What did she do? What part of the story does she have? And what ended up happening to her? So she's a surrogate mother of Moshe, which itself is very, very interesting. So now you're back to surrogate motherhood, right? She raises Moshe for the Jewish people, right? Instead of her own dreams or whatever. So that's, one second, isn't that fascinating that you see, and can you all admit that you all knew about her and you never thought about comparing her with Hagar before, right? So it was worth coming just for that. But what you may not know is in Divrei HaYamim, it tells us, look at source number 8, V'ishto ha-Yehudiya, that's also interesting, Yolda et Yered Avigdor ve'et Chever Avishocho v'et Yikutiel Avizonach ve'eil b'nei Bithya bat Paro asher l'kach merit. That Bithya, the daughter of Paro, married one of the Jews and left Egypt together with Am Yisrael when the Exodus took place. So therefore, over here you have the daughter being a surrogate mother, raising Moshe Rabbeinu, and then joining the Jewish people and happy to be her role, whatever it is. So what do we then do with all this? Because over here, yeah, the Masei Avot, but they go in two different directions. And my suggestion then is, yeah, there is some kind of a, what I would call a larger model over here, but the protagonists within the larger model always have free will. And the story can end up being parallel stories, but nobody said they have to end up working out the exact same way, which if anything, what I'm really saying then is the fact that Bithya succeeds in her role as surrogate mother for Moshe and then leaves and is happy to join the Jewish people, that then becomes a condemnation against Hagar, who's unwilling to take her role and to understand who she is. And instead, what she does with this is she does the opposite, and she ends up demeaning Sarah Imenu, trying to diminish Sarah, put her down. Again, those are the words of the Torah, trying to diminish Sarah in order to elevate her own stature over here, in order to, as I said, to stake the claim that she really is the one to take place. So I'm saying that even though I've been quoting a lot of Midrashim over here, maybe it comes as a surprise to you that the Midrashim actually have a little more textual basis within the larger story over here than you may ever have suspected.
Could that mean that if...
By the way, anything you say could, I'm going to say yes.
Could that mean